Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today we're going to be talking about choosing between assisted reproduction and adoption. This is a topic that we see a lot of people face, especially if they have had a failed IVF cycle or two. They then have to make the decisions of what they're going to do for their next step, and this is a decision many of them face. I thought the show was absolutely great. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
I think I always like to begin with being able to turn inward and say, what are the things that are important to me? For most people, the desire to have a genetic child is their first choice. But to borrow the line, it doesn't mean that going the next step, whether it be on to adoption or to a donor, is going to be a second best experience.
I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit, and you can find us online at creatingafamily.org. We have online courses for adoptive parents and adoption professionals. One of the courses that I think would be particularly interesting to people listening to this show is Legal and Medical Considerations When Deciding on Domestic Infant Adoption. I encourage you to check out that course under the online courses tab on our website, creatingafamily.org. We also produce multimedia guides, and we've got a couple that I think would be helpful for you. One, how to choose an infertility clinic. We include lots and lots of resources, practical resources, as well as questionnaires, tip sheets, and things such as that. We also have a multimedia guide on choosing an adoption attorney or adoption agency. Again, that one's 52 pages with lots and lots of information. You can reach any of those by going to our website, click on hover over the resource tab, and then click on e-guides, and it will take you right there. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical, and we thank them for their continued support for making this show happen. In addition to Ferring, we also have gold sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson, a South Carolina firm committed to adoption and assisted reproductive law, including providing a gestational surrogacy matching program, as well as legal services for independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation, and then, of course, legal services for adoption. We also have Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of prospective sperm donors. This provides the client with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. In addition to those sponsors, we also have other sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an adoption or infertility service provider, please consider choosing one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, services provided, just a host of factors that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. Today, we'll be talking about choosing between assisted reproduction and adoption. Our guest today to talk with us about this very informative topic is Colleen Quinn. She is an attorney specializing in reproductive law and adoption with Locke and Quinn in Richmond, Virginia, and Andrea Braverman. She is a therapist specializing in infertility and third-party family building with the Braverman Center for Health Journeys. She is also an associate professor in the departments of obstetrics and gynecology and psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University. Welcome, Andrea and Colleen, to Creating a Family.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Well, I think we need to start. Those of us in the field automatically know what we mean when we say assisted reproduction. But the reality is, for a lot of people listening, although our audience tends to be fairly knowledgeable, but for a lot of people who are new to this field, they have no idea what that means. Assisted reproduction also goes by the term third-party reproduction. And for today's show, what we are referring to when we say that is donor sperm, donor egg, donor embryo, or surrogacy. Anything else that I am leaving out, Andrea, when you think of third-party reproduction or assisted reproduction?
Probably the only thing that I think of is sometimes people are doing donor egg and donor sperm rather than donor embryo, too.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, that's a great point. It's sometimes called a double donor IVF cycle. It goes by other things, or double donor cycle or something along those lines. So, yes, some of this, it shouldn't be an or, it should be an and when discussing those. All right, I want to start by walking through the actual process that a patient would use if they decide to use donor gametes, and gametes mean egg or sperm. So let's start with that. Colleen, so somebody has had a failed cycle or two of IVF, or they have been told by their reproductive endocrinologist that their odds of success with IUI, intrauterine insemination, IVF, in vitro fertilization, are very low. So they make the decision, well, you know, they're going to go straight there. So what's that process look like? Let's start with donor sperm.
Well, typically, most men will have their sperm checked to check the motility, and Andrea might be able to address that more from a medical standpoint, but when I have somebody that they're having issues with their sperm being effective, and they've looked to ICSI, which is ICSI, intracytoplasmic injection, which is where the doctors can take one sperm and inject it into the nucleus of the egg to help facilitate conception. If it's pretty clear that that they're going to need to use donor sperm, then basically I direct them to look at the various cryobanks that are out there. And, of course, historically sperm has been frozen for decades now, and there are a plethora of cryobanks out there. Pretty much all of my lesbian couples will, if they don't have a known donor and do a known donor agreement with that known donor, they will typically go to a cryobank and pick most often an anonymous donor, although some cryobanks allow for some later connection between them and the donor, depending on the donor's preferences. So
let me stop you there. I actually think that now, from what I talk to with the cryobanks, I actually think that I think all cryobanks have the another word for cryobank, by the way, is sperm bank. I think most have the option for a known or identified donor now. And, in fact, many of them are telling me that the majority of their families are coming in requesting that, and that now the majority of their donors are open to that. So I'm just saying, just thought I'd throw that out. Go ahead. So
I think that's an excellent point, because that is the trend. And, you know, of course, we all know it's best for the child ultimately to have that information rather than be searching on
that.
Some registry. Right.
We have a lot of discussion on that coming up. So go ahead.
Yeah. So from a legal standpoint, though, in terms of acquiring donor sperm, the key thing is that there is a really solid donor release that has been obtained out of the clinic, so that there's been a complete release of any potential parentage. And then with a known donor, we will typically have a contract directly between the donor and the recipients. And we're actually trying to encourage a lot of the cryobanks to do more direct donor agreements as well, just so that there is what we call parity of contract directly between the donors and the recipients. But that's really not doable as much in some of the anonymous donor cases where they've already donated some 5 years earlier.
Right, yeah. And that way they would both sign something that says that the donor does not intend to have any parental rights and will have no parental responsibilities, including child support.
Right, and they typically will have a direct agreement with regard to any future contact. If the donor knows of medical issues that arise in his family, a duty to report back, and if the recipients know of issues that arise with the child, a duty to report back. Those sorts of issues are more directly linked when you have a direct agreement as opposed to a clinic release.
All right, so the couple or the single woman will go will obtain sperm in one way or the other, and then she would choose to. There is such a thing as home insemination. However, you can also choose to have the insemination done at an infertility clinic or your gynecologist's office, and it could be through intrauterine or intracervical insemination, and all of those are options. However, if you have struggled with infertility, as Colleen mentioned, you might at this point use the donor sperm in an IVF cycle, and that would be going through your infertility clinic. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the walking through for donor sperm. Now,
right. Well, real quickly,
Dawn, sure.
I'm sorry. You want to get Andrea to comment too, but I just as a quick aside, some people will look to a friend to be their donor or the donor of their sperm. And we have the interesting case out of Roanoke here in Virginia, the city of Roanoke, where the woman asked her friend to be a donor, and they did not have a donor agreement in place, and she used a turkey baster to inseminate herself as opposed to like a home insemination kit bought from the drugstore. And she thought he was a donor. He thought they were going to co-parent. The court ruled that a turkey baster is not an intervening medical technology under Virginia law, and he did not qualify as a donor, and therefore he was a dad. So that intervening medical technology and whether a home insemination kit qualifies under different state statutes is really something important to note, and we make sure in our donor agreements that a home insemination kit is being considered an intervening medical technology by the parties.
Oh, that's a really good point. And each state would have different laws on that, so you would need to check with a reproductive or an attorney that specializes in reproductive law in the state where you live. Although, quite frankly, if you should always have a contract, and if you have a contract, then that should be addressed in the contract. Okay, now let's walk through the process of egg donation. Let's hit the high points of what that entails. Andrea, can you walk us through, and then we will turn to and ask Colleen any specific legal things that need to be considered with that process. So, yeah, walk us through kind of an overview of what we mean by egg donation and what's involved. Andrea.
Sure, happy to do that. With egg donation, in many ways, the parallels to sperm donation is this is a case where either an individual intended parent or a couple need eggs. One or both are unable to supply the eggs, and so they're looking for a donor. Until recently, that meant that you were finding a woman who was going to be your egg donor. She would go through an in vitro fertilization, IVF cycle, at the same time, usually, that the recipient was going to be preparing her uterus, or if there was a surrogate involved, the surrogate was preparing her uterus. And then the eggs would be retrieved, they would be inseminated with sperm, and then the embryos would belong to the recipient parents, and one or two would be transferred. Very recently, in the last few years, we've been able to freeze an unfertilized egg. We weren't really very good at doing that, and it defied freezing on its own, and so we had those concurrent fresh cycles. Now, with the advent of egg freezing, we have egg banks. So when we say cryobanks, it's actually a large umbrella, meaning both a sperm bank and an egg bank. And an egg bank, it is very similar to the sperm bank in which the eggs are frozen, only in this case in lots usually of six eggs, with the idea that out of six eggs that at least one good embryo could be created and a child born. And the donors are listed in catalogs just like they are with sperm banks. And you go to the cryobank and you select a donor. Once the donor is selected, it is a frozen egg. The eggs are thawed. They are inseminated at that point. Fertilization hopefully occurs. We don't usually expect if you have six eggs, you're going to get six fertilized eggs. And so there, you watch as the eggs fertilize, develop. Hopefully some, if not most, will develop into embryos. And then usually these days a single embryo will be, or a further an embryo that's developed further, and you'll hear the term blastocyst, which is just a further down the road development of that embryo. It's a single embryo or a single blastocyst is transferred to the recipient's uterus, or if they can't do that, then to a surrogate uterus.
And I will say that Creating a Family has a number of resources on making decisions between choosing a fresh donor or a donor that a woman who's in or going to a frozen egg bank. There are a lot of decisions to be made, and there's pros and cons. So I would refer people to look to those as well. All right. So we've talked about donor sperm and donor egg. Let's walk through, and let me just say that with surrogacy, it is the same process, except for involved in that you would also be hiring a surrogate. Most often that would be the woman who would not be contributing her own egg. She would be the recipient of the transfer of the embryo that is created from either the donor egg or the donor sperm. It is possible, and it is legal in some states, for her to contribute both the egg as well as be the surrogate and carry the baby to term. But usually nowadays she is what's called a gestational surrogate. All right, now let's talk about donor embryo. Oh, whoa, wait a second. Before we do that, let me swing back and say, Colleen, any specific things that would be that people need to know about from a legal standpoint with that would be distinct from what you've already said with donor sperm as it would relate to donor egg?
The only observation I would have is that we do have more direct agreements between the recipients and the donors in the egg donor world as opposed to the sperm donation. And I think that's because over time we've recognized the importance of having direct donor-recipient agreements, and with the event of the egg freezing occurring later in time, we have the luxury of having that that hindsight. So there are still anonymous donors who you can get a lot of information about. And we're actually very easily able to do direct agreements between anonymous egg donors and intended parents. So I often tell clients, it's okay if you want to have that anonymity. We can still do a direct agreement, and the attorneys have figured out how to keep that anonymity while still having that privity of contract between the parties. And then the other thing I would just note is that generally it seems the cost of the banked eggs seems to be less than the cost of picking a donor who still has to have her eggs retrieved.
Yeah, we go through all that in our resources. The other thing to consider is that you may end up with more eggs if you go with a specific donor versus the egg bank. All of those things are things you have to weigh, and there's actually no guarantee of that if you go with a live donor versus a frozen egg bank. In an attempt, I want to get to the adoption process, but let me, I have recently been doing some research, and Creating a Family has a lot of information on embryo donation, so I'm going to briefly summarize that process. Generally speaking, when people have gone through IVF, they may end up with embryos that they do not want to use, usually because they have been successful and they've got the family size that they're comfortable with. One of the options they have when they have embryos left over is to donate them to another couple for family building. There are a couple of different ways, really three different ways that you can access donated embryo. One is that you can access them through an infertility clinic. Most clinics require that you already be a patient of that clinic before you can enroll in their donor embryo program. So that is one option, and they treat it as a medical procedure, and the cost is usually associated with a frozen embryo transfer. Another way that you can find donated embryos is to work with, and usually it is an adoption agency that has an embryo donation program. They often call their programs embryo adoption because they follow an adoption model, meaning that the donating couple can select the recipient couple. There is also the donating couple can specify certain things that they would like to see in the recipient. And I shouldn't have said couple because it could be a single person as well. And usually there is some form of background check research done into the recipient couple, and some donating couples prefer that. So that is using an adoption agency. And then there is another model. There are a few clinics that have been set up that are specific to embryo donation. And they usually have the option of either, not all of them actually, there's only two that I know of. One has the option of following more of the adoption model, and the other one, as well as the medical model. And the other one, I think, just follows the adoption model. So, that is my run-through, my Cliff Note version of embryo donation. I do recommend people go to our site. We have a lot of resources on this. You can go to either, actually, the Adoption Resource Guide or the Infertility Resource Guide and click on embryo donation, and it will take you to more resources than you will want. Anything, Colleen, that you would like to add to that? From a legal standpoint, obviously there also needs to be legal agreements signed as well. Anything that you'd like to add to that before we move on?
Just that with embryo donation, there is no genetic relation between the carrier of the embryo. So if intended parents have a donated embryo carried by the intended mother, or and if it's carried by the intended mother, most state laws will presume her to be the mother because she's the gestational mother. But if they use a gestational carrier, there are a handful of states that will allow a pre-birth order saying that the intended parents who have no genetic connection to this embryo but who legally own this embryo are going to be the legal parents of this child, and so the pre-birth order deems them the legal parents. So there's a handful of states that do that. But in the vast majority of states, an adoption still has to take place if the intended parents are using a donated embryo with a gestational carrier.
Okay, excellent. All right. Now I'd like to move to the adoption process. Before I do that, Andrea, is there anything you wanted to add about third-party reproduction, just kind of the process, before we move on to talking about the adoption process? And then we're going to move into talking about similarities and differences and things that people should consider.
I think the only thing I would add is, and we'll get to this further down the line in our discussion, is we're talking about this in very factual and pragmatic ways, and obviously there are just so many feelings that are associated with each decision and the importance of the choices that are made, as well as some of the complications or challenges. And so along with the legal and the medical considerations are the ones about what building your family, forming a family, issues that are going to entail, and issues that may need to be tackled down the road. So I'll just sort of leave that as a big umbrella, and then we can talk in more detail.
Okay, Anthony, we absolutely will. We could, and we have done entire shows talking about the adoption process for each of the three major types of adoption: domestic infant, foster care, and international. Obviously, we do not have the time to go through the entire process, but I do want to touch on it very briefly. For more detail, I would recommend that you go to creatingafamily.org, hover over the tab Adoption at the very top, and then click on our A to Z resource guide, and then we have extensive resources there on literally everything you might want to know about each of the three major types of adoption. But Colleen, if you could just briefly tell us what the adoption process for a domestic infant adoption would be, just so that people have that in mind, so that they will understand better as we start drawing distinctions and differences.
Right. So first of all, we still have a very high demand of adoptive families with a low supply of women who are choosing to place their child for adoption. So it still tends to be an area where for a family to be able to achieve an infant adoption can still take some considerable time and effort and networking in order to have that happen. And of course, you know, there's a variety of issues that come up, including there are children that are born very healthy, and then there are others that might have significant medical needs or might have been drug exposed, et cetera. So there's definitely kind of a spectrum of the children that are available as infants, some being very healthy infants and others having more needs that the adoptive parents have to take into consideration. So it's
I suppose in some ways
still,
the same can be said about any at the birth of any child, although you do have more control
right.
over the intrauterine environment if you're carrying the child. Okay, just briefly then, from a domestic infant adoption standpoint, and this is truly going to be a very brief overview. The prospective adoptive family would contact either an adoption agency or an adoption attorney, and that somewhat depends on the state as to what adoption attorneys can do. And they would work with the agency or the attorney to find an expectant woman who may be considering adoption as a plan for her unborn child. They would go through a home study process, which is meeting with social workers, and it also includes background checks and things such as that. Usually it is birth mother or expectant mom choice, meaning that the adoptive family prepares a profile. It is submitted to expectant couples or expectant woman. She looks through a number of them, selects the family that she would like for her to parent her child. You are matched. She can change her mind at any point until after birth and when she has signed the relinquishment papers, and that time period varies by state. At that point, the child is yours, and you go through a legal adoption, usually around the six-month point at that point. So that's just a cursory review. And most adoptions now have some degree of what is called openness. Openness is not a defined term, but it means identifying contact. It can mean identifying contact. It can mean letters. It can mean sending pictures a couple of times a year. And it can also mean scheduling times for visits. So it can mean any of those things. And that is something that both the expectant parents and the adoptive parents agree to. Anything else that you would like to add, either of you, to that very quick just overview of what we mean by domestic infant adoption? Andrea, anything you want to add?
No, I don't. I think that's great.
Okay. Colleen, anything in addition to that, the rapid version?
No, your rapid version was fabulous. I don't know when we're going to get into the pros and cons of using a carrier versus having an adoption.
Yeah.
Right, because there's a lot to be said about making that decision. Yes.
Yeah, we're absolutely going to come to that. I wanted to lay the groundwork for people who we often find people, particularly those coming, obviously, from infertility treatment, don't really have even an idea of what their options are on third-party reproduction or adoption. So, and we could see that from some of the questions we got. So we're going to kind of start with giving them a basic overview. Let me do a real quick rundown on foster adoption as well. And that there are children, 400,000 some odd kids nationally in foster care. Of those, approximately 100,000 are legally free to be adopted. The others are not. And the process for foster care adoption, it's actually fairly complex, so it's hard to do a really quick summary. But you can either adopt a child that is legally free. Most of those children are over the age of 6. The process then is to contact either your state agency or foster care agency or a private agency, if your state allows private agencies to place children, and you go through very much a similar process. You go through an education and you go through a home study, and the child is often, during this process, you may have the child be able to visit with the child, then the child is placed in your home. Usually about at least a 6-month period goes by, and before you can finalize the adoption, and allows both the child and the parents to better understand what parenting this child will mean. However, there is also the option of going in and fostering first. The goal of foster care is family reunification, so you go in knowing that the child that is placed with you may not become yours. The family, the birth family may be able to be healed, that is the goal, or an extended family might want to adopt the child. If that happens, the child goes back. However, if the family is not able to reunify with the child, almost always, although not always, but almost always, the foster parents are given the first choice on adopting that child. And children available for foster care adoption can go anywhere from infants all the way up to teens. So that's, in a nutshell, foster care. And let me quickly throw out international. International adoption is many countries place children internationally. And the family connects with an adoption agency. You must work with an adoption agency. You go through a home study and an education process. They help you select a country, or you select a country first. The child is referred, the terminology is referred to you, meaning that a specific child has been identified, and you receive some information depending on the country. Depends on how much detail you were given. And you have information on this child, and then you make a decision whether to go forward. The vast majority of international adoptions do require you to travel to the child's country, and the process, it can take anywhere, quite frankly. It just depends on the country, and it depends on the type of child you are looking for as to the amount of time it might take. So there, those are the three major types of adoption and just a very quick overview. Now, I want to dive into the meat of our show, which is talking about things that families should think of when they're sitting on the precipice thinking, all right, we are not going to go through another IVF cycle the way we've been doing because it hasn't worked. Or the doctor is encouraging us not to even try the first one. So we could choose to go through third-party, in this case, donor egg, if you believe it is a problematic with the egg, or donor sperm, obviously if you believe the problems with the sperm, or both, as Andrew pointed out. You can use a donor egg or a donor and donor sperm, or donor embryo. So what are some of the things that you think families should think about when they are trying to make that decision? And I didn't say, or obviously the other option would be to consider adoption. Andrea, let's start with you. What are some of the things that you think people need to think about when they're getting ready to make what is a hugely important decision?
it's one of those things where it's sort of, where do you want to begin with this? But I think I always like to begin with being able to turn inward and say, what are the things that are important to me? For most people, the desire to have a genetic child is their first choice. But to borrow the line, it doesn't mean that going the next step, whether it be on to adoption or to a donor, is going to be a second best experience. Having said that, sometimes it is breaking down, what it means to that individual. For example, I talk to a lot of women who say, I need to move on to donor egg. My eggs are not fertilizing, or the doctor, we've tried too many times and it looks like my egg quality is just not that good. And I can do egg donor, I can adopt. And for a lot of them, they have to start with saying, all right, if the end goal is having a child to love, that's great, but both choices have different things that I have to explore. So if I am going on to adoption, I'm not going to have that opportunity to carry the pregnancy, and usually not that ability to nurse the child. Some people say to me, that is a big part of it. It's not just about having a genetic offspring, but it's the whole experience of the pregnancy. Or if they have a partner, our experience together of having that pregnancy, delivery, being able to breastfeed the child. And for somebody like that, that might sway them to say, we're not even going to touch all the other issues. We're just going... That's sort of the card that rises to the top of the deck for me emotionally. For others, and I certainly have talked to women who say, the pregnancy wasn't the part that I was really looking forward to. And for them, that's not an additional experience that they're giving up on the road to building their family. I think for some, they come to the decision also sometimes exhausted from the technology and the trying. And for many, they'll say adoption is just feels no longer that same emotional roller coaster ride of saying, what are the quality of the eggs? What's going to fertilize? What's going to develop? What's going to transfer? Will it implant? And they feel that adoption is a clearer pathway to parenthood without the twists and turns they've been experiencing. I think the other part that comes up is also jumping from the immediate experience to down the road. And I think for a lot of families, really considering what it means to raise the child. I think that it's beginning to change, but I think a lot of people sometimes will say adoption feels like a more comfortable road to go, because adoption is something understood by everybody. I always say, if you walk up to anybody in the street and say, hey, I'm going to adopt, you're usually greeted with a smile and congratulations. But if you do that same thing, walk up to the same person and say, hey, guess what, I'm going to use a donor, you don't get that same kind of response. People don't have that familiarity. So, and that translates down the road, raising the child. I know I can walk into any library and there are books both for parents and for children about adoption, but the books out there on egg donation or sperm donation is, in the dozen to two dozen range. And so feeling like, as a parent down the road, which feels that I feel more, that I feel better equipped to raise this child and the issues that I want to tackle. I think on top of that,
Well, let me just throw something in there, is that also we have more research. And I don't know whether that's important to you, but there's been, eons of research on how adopted children fare. And one of the things that we hear from people is that they don't know how donor conceived. There is some research, but the quantity is certainly not there. I'm just sorry to interrupt. Keep talking.
No, and I think that's exactly right. One is familiar, one is less familiar. One is the road that is certainly well-traveled. Adoption goes back to, day one of people, and egg donation is the new kid on the block, only starting in the early 80s, and sperm donation back at the turn of the last century in the late 1800s. and not really, despite having 100 years on, wasn't really studied at all. So I think that for those are things that people consider. But I think the other thing is, and this is where I think people feel they get into the less comfortable range, the sort of assumption of what am I supposed to want, and then having to confront what the feelings really are. So, for example, that when people are selecting a donor, they usually select a donor who is very similar to them in background. In adoption, often the birth parents are not similar to the adoptive parents in background. That's neither good or bad. It's just it's a different experience. I think the other and is just even in terms of weight. It used to be with egg donation, we had to wait for over a year before we could match somebody with an egg donor. Now, with egg banks and just as it's become more and more of a family-building option, for many intended parents I talk to, they're choosing egg donation because they don't feel that there is that weight, that it, somehow it feels a little bit more in control. They're not developing a their own story to present to a potential birth parent. And, you know, so again, there are all these nuances, and I don't want to take up any more time, but just to say, you know, you're looking at all these complexities, and the only thing I always encourage everybody to do is to take the time to sit down, to let them, to explore them, and unravel all the different threads that get tangled up together.
Let me stop for a moment and remind everyone that you are listening to Creating a Family, and today we are talking about choosing between assisted reproduction and adoption. Creating a Family has one of the largest online networks in the fields of both adoption and infertility. Clout, the online influence ranker, now ranks us as either number one or number two in both adoption or infertility. It kind of depends on the day. We would love to have you join our network. We hang out primarily at Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. There are three ways to connect with us on Facebook. You can connect with me personally at dawn.davenport1. You can also like our Facebook page, which is Creating a Family, facebook.com/creatingafamily. Or you can join our online support group. We are well over 7,000 strong. It is a very active group. You can join that at facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily. Or quite frankly, the easiest way is just to type in Creating a Family in the Facebook search box. You can like both the group and the page will pop up. You can like the group, like the page and join the group. It is a closed group, so you will have to wait to be admitted. On Twitter and Pinterest, we are at Creating a Family, and you can find us that way. All right. We have a question. It's quite long. I'm going to summarize it. Basically, it is a couple that is trying to decide between hiring a surrogate to do a double donor cycle, a donor egg or donor sperm, or to go the adoption route, and they would like to help someone think, they would like help in thinking through some of the things that they should consider. A lot of the information I am leaving out is what they have gone through. They have been in infertility for a long time and have gone through a lot of different things and have come to the conclusion that these are their best options. Colleen, you had mentioned at the beginning that one of the things that you wanted to talk about was the distinctions between hiring a surrogate or going the adoption route. So can you give some thoughts to this couple?
Sure. I oftentimes have clients come in and they're looking at comparing use of a gestational carrier versus adoption. And I oftentimes break it down into several categories, the first being cost, the second being risk, the third being control, and the fourth being more the relationship. And, of course, when we're looking at donor parts, we can break it down into those same categories. But just focusing on the use of a gestational carrier versus the adoption route and looking at cost, of course, adoption is generally going to cost less than using a gestational carrier if a couple does find an altruistic or compassionate carrier who is not looking to be compensated but just looking to not come out of pocket, then usually the costs allocated to the carrier are under $5,000, and most of the costs are medical and legal. But using an altruistic or compassionate carrier can run about $30,000 to $40,000, which is right around where a number of the domestic agency adoptions are landing right now, with domestic parental or what we call independent or private placement adoptions. They can be done for considerably less. In fact, where folks actually are able to network and find their own birth mother in-state in Virginia, by way of example, we can actually do an adoption for under $15,000. So you can see that using an altruistic gestational carrier is going to be bumping up at the high range of doing a domestic adoption. And then if the carrier is being compensated or receiving funds, then typically the average carrier, when you add in the what we call the base monthly allowance over generally 8 to 10 months, plus what we call the add-ons, which are allowances for maternity clothes and for their attorney, and if they have a C-section or if they're carrying multiples, when you add all of those things in, you're typically looking at a minimum of $25,000, and then bumping up to $35,000 and $40,000, with repeat carriers making even more. So when we look at the overall cost of using a carrier, if it's not the altruistic or compassionate carrier that is the best friend or sister or cousin, then we're looking pretty much at a minimum of about $60,000 and on upwards, with some gestational carrier arrangements being in the $80,000 to $100,000, again, depending on surrogacy program costs, medical costs, how much the carrier is receiving. So cost tends to be one of the largest factors. Then when we look at the risk,
let me throw in, cost to foster care is minimal. Oftentimes it is free. And international adoption cost range, very similar to the $30,000 to $40,000 that you quoted for an agency adoption. Okay, now go on to talking about, were you talking risk or control next?
Risk. Yep, gotcha. Risk and control, they kind of go hand in glove with each other. But basically, the risk in an adoption is the placing mother changing her mind and not placing. But there is a child in utero or a child that's actually been born. The risk with using a gestational carrier is that she won't get pregnant, that you will have several embryo transfers and it simply won't happen, but there'll have been the money spent on the prerequisites, her mental health screening, et cetera. It won't be the same cost because if she doesn't get pregnant, she's not going to end up earning that monthly base and the other items. But there will be an initial cost for the formation of the embryo, the cost of the embryo transfer. So most of the medical costs will still be there and most of the legal costs will still be there. So there can be a great investment with the risk being that she won't get pregnant. And for families that have already been through a lot of infertility treatments and spent a lot of money on IU or IVF, sometimes they're just tired of spending money on medical procedures and just no longer want to take that risk of not having a pregnancy or having to suffer through another miscarriage, even if it's not the intended mother's miscarriage. If it's a gestational carrier's miscarriage, it's just as devastating. So that's the risk factor. The control factor, again, the control when you're using a carrier is that she's under contract. So she's pretty much agreed to abide by all medical instructions, not use drugs, alcohol, tobacco, and we get into really great detail about, you know, avoiding places with the Zika virus and many other things, no tattoos, piercings, et cetera. So there's a lot of control over the prenatal care. There's control over the genetics because even if you're using donor egg and donor sperm, you're still looking at the genetics of the donors. And so there's just much more control in that regard. Versus an adoption, there really is no control over the genetics. The the placing mom is the mom that you've selected or selected you, and her genetics are what they are. And there's not as much control over her prenatal care. She may be smoking throughout the pregnancy, et cetera. So I kind of make folks understand that control factor. And these are just kind of the base factors. There's a lot more minutiae, which Andrea kind of referred to as well. But the final thing would be the relationship. With a carrier, it's unless it's an altruistic or compassionate carrier who's been like a best friend or family member, it's many times, while it's a great relationship, it's more of a business relationship. And so, you know, folks are, they've got a contract, they have to abide by the contract, and they may or may not have a continued relationship after the child is born. It may be the carrier would like some picture letter updates, but there's not as, it's not as critical. With a placing mom, and you mentioned earlier, Dawn, openness, and we've got so much more openness in adoption now with so many more of the millennial women that are placing for adoption wanting to have ongoing contact, ongoing information, and that's so critical for the child too. So the relationship is a little bit different. It's not so much a business relationship. It's more of a in some ways, a lot of times, kind of a paternal relationship. The adoptive parents tend to be older than the placing mom and almost take her under their wing, and then there tends to be ongoing contact afterwards and more openness. It's just a different type of relationship. There are a lot of other details I could go into and other compare-contrast, but I would say those are the four kind of big ones that jump out.
Before we go on, let me, Andrea, do you have anything to add? The thing that I want to go into is the knowing the genetics so I want to talk some about that because we've got a lot of questions on that. But before I do, any other thoughts for factors that couples should consider if their consideration is using a gestational carrier without a genetic connection? In this particular couple's case, they are considering a dual using both donated sperm and egg, but it would be similar to using a donated embryo as well. Any other thoughts for things they should consider in making this decision?
I would just add what we were talking about before, which is thinking about raising this child as they are growing and how you are telling them their story and how the parents feel about telling the two different stories. And understanding and being responsive to what issues may arise for their child or children about it. You know, in adoption, there is the story of why, you know, the birth parents made a choice to place that child for adoption. Donation, when you're using a double donation, it's a different story, which is that these are two unrelated donors, and that the curiosity may take them in a different road rather than saying, there was no me that you placed. It was, you know, we're one of X number of eggs or sperm, and how that curiosity might be different. And the reality is we don't have a whole lot of research at all, particularly with a double donor situation. So it's more, are you comfortable with helping your child navigate perhaps a road that has less guideposts on it? And those are just some of the things I would add to that beautifully outlined discussion of choice.
And that's a good segue into, we received a lot of questions talking about similarities between closed adoption, and which used to be the primary way adoption was practiced, not even all that many years ago, 10, 15 years ago it was still being practiced, where the majority of times the adoptive parents and the adopted person, the child, would have no access. In fact, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. I have known it. There are a number of states that still forbid adopted adults from getting information about their birth parents. So, and the questions all somewhat focus on the how similar is closed adoption to anonymous donation. And the advantages and the disadvantages for families to consider at this stage when they're making this decision. Andrea, let me ask that question to you.
So the similarities and differences with a
closed adoption and anonymous donation.
The similarities are more when you look at it from the child's perspective about identity formation, if access to information, knowledge about oneself, and I think that in some ways the similarity is saying there are things about my history and myself that are not readily available to me, and I think that sets children on and adults on different paths to wanting to get that information. I think where it is, and I would say the differences exist in terms of what I was speaking about before, of saying what choices were made by the genetic parent, if you will, as opposed to about how they sort of came to be. So I think that's where they are similar, but how they can also be different. With adoption, there is a story behind it. With donation, there's kind of less of a more complex story, if you will.
Has there been much research into donor-conceived people as to the preference for open or the ability to access identifying information at maturity versus closed or anonymous donation? I'll ask that to both of you. Andrea, you probably have studied the research more, so I'll direct it to you.
All right, I'll jump in on the research because that I do read. There is an emerging field in the research of this, and a lot of it also is coming from abroad because other countries have different laws around this. For example, in England, Australia, Sweden, you cannot have an anonymous donor anymore. Every child or adult has the right to access information on their donor at a certain age. In the United States, even though there's a trend toward more having these identity release or open donors available, it is certainly not law. But the research that's sort of emerging and is pretty loud and clear that donor-conceived people want that option for information about their genetic background. And for many, if you see in the few studies that are emerging, what the donor-conceived persons are saying is not that they want to be able to seek a parent. They're not looking for their quote-unquote real mom or dad, but more saying, who is this donor to me? How do I make sense? There's intense curiosity around it. And I think that you do see a range of behaviors and feelings around it, and some donor-conceived persons will say, no, this person is critically important to me. I must know them in order to know myself. And you see others at the other end, if you think of a normal distribution on the other end of the curve, saying, yeah, not so important to me. But the problem that with all of this is it's complicated about when you ask someone. If you're asking an 8, mm-hmm. an 18-year-old, or a 38-year-old, mm-hmm. these have different meanings and resonate in different ways. And
such a
the
good
one
point.
Thing, yeah, and the last thing I just mentioned is with the introduction of the internet early on, relatively in the donor gamete world, that's also changed things tremendously because people are able to connect on the internet. And so there are self-registries like the Donor Sibling Registry, where they come with, obviously just even from the name, there's a bias that genetic connection makes for kinship. Now, others don't feel that way. And the one caution I always say is when you look at the literature, often it is surveys off of single websites that may have a bias toward them. So I think we still have a lot to learn.
You know, and it is absolutely true. And I would refer people to a Creating a Family show we did a couple of years ago with a panel of donor-conceived adults, all conceived through sperm donation, because we actually don't have egg donation hasn't been around long enough for those people to reach majority and in the numbers that we would need to form a panel. And it was a fascinating show. It is a moment in time, and I appreciate what you said, because we, all of us humans, continue to evolve. And so this, how they felt at the time they were being interviewed may not be reflective of how they're going to feel 10 years from now. But if you're ever thinking about not telling your child about donor conception, I cannot recommend that show enough, because a number of the, I think two of the people found out by accident as adults. And listening to them talk, it is hard to think that you would want to make that choice for your child. So I strongly recommend that. Let me take a break briefly to remind you of a few more of our gold sponsors who have allowed us through their support of us, Creating a Family as an organization and show. They believe in our mission and they support us, and it is through their support that we're able to bring you this show. We have Children's Connection, an adoption agency providing services for domestic infant adoption and embryo donation and adoption throughout the United States, as well as home studies and post-adoption support to families in Texas. And we have Nightlight Christian Adoptions. In 1997, they began the first embryo adoption program in the world, and they named it Snowflakes Embryo Adoption. Now more than 450 Snowflake babies have been born as a result of directed embryo donation. You can get more information about any of our sponsors by going to our website and going to the service provider page, or to our directory, which you can find on that page. Colleen, we talked about the cost differences between hiring a gestational carrier and using either donated, and at the time you were specifically referring to donated egg and donated sperm. Can you talk about some of the cost differences for doing just sperm donation or egg donation, utilizing the gamete from the other partner in this case? And also the issue of predictability, or the potential risk associated with sunk money, sunk investment. Go ahead.
So going back before, when we were talking about using the gestational carrier with donor egg and donor sperm, that actually will be an even more expensive arrangement than normal, because now you're not using the gametes of the intended parents. You're having to purchase the sperm and purchase the egg, so that tends to be one of, especially if you're not using a compassionate or altruistic carrier, it tends to be one of the more expensive arrangements.
You'd probably expect it to be over 100, wouldn't you, if you're getting donor egg, donor sperm, and hiring a surrogate? Would you think that that would probably be all told, including the medical procedure, of course, because you're having to pay for the retrieval for the egg, a donor, and then the surrogacy? Would you think that would probably be somewhere in the range of $100,000?
Yes, especially if you're talking about a donor that you're selecting, you still have to retrieve the eggs from. It would actually be less expensive to purchase frozen embryos from an embryo bank that's already formed, because you'd also have the cost of the embryo formation as well.
No, you mean frozen egg, not frozen embryo, didn't you? Egg bank?
It would be less expensive to purchase frozen egg, but actually for that couple would be actually less expensive to purchase, rather than frozen sperm and frozen egg separately. It would be less expensive for them to purchase an embryo already in storage.
I'm just going to say, I don't think it is legal anywhere in the U.S. to purchase an embryo.
To acquire one through donation, I think would be
really clear about that. you cannot buy embryos, which is one reason, quite frankly. I mean, that ties directly to my question to you, and that is, donated embryos are a less expensive option because you can't purchase them.
You're paying for the donation process. I think that's an excellent point. I should be careful about my terminology in terms of buying commodities here.
Yeah.
Um, so So basically, going back to your question, though, I mean, the least expensive route in art is to acquire donor sperm. You know, if you have an intended mother that is capable of getting pregnant through artificial insemination with donor sperm, that can be done, you know, by purchasing one vial and attempting, and then if that doesn't take, then purchasing the next vial. And so that's easily going to be, depending on how many vials, but if you're paying $200, $300 for a vial or whatever, it's going to be the least expensive. The next would be using donor egg with a woman that can carry. So, again, that donor egg would have to still be combined with the sperm, and so it would have to be fertilized and the embryo created. So now there's the cost of the embryo transfer procedure, but if that embryo is being transferred into the intended mother who is capable of carrying a pregnancy, then that's going to be way less expensive than having to use a gestational carrier. And then even acquiring a donated embryo, being really careful of my phrasing here, and having that transferred into the intended mother who's capable of carrying, again, is going to be far less expensive than having to use a gestational carrier. And so for either route, that is acquiring the donor egg and having it fertilized and then transferred, or for acquiring the donated embryo and having that transferred into the intended mother, you're typically looking in the $15,000 to $25,000 range. Of course, it varies across the country. Clinics in cities can be more expensive than clinics in more rural areas. So maybe we should say in the $15,000 to $30,000 range. And then again, it depends on whether you're paying per embryo transfer. So there are a lot of variations. But you can still see that that's way less than using a gestational carrier.
You know, let me throw this out there. I think that we did some research about a year or so ago on the cost of using a donated embryo. And I think a lot of people were very surprised by the variance in cost, depending on which way you choose. There are some clinics that charge simply for a frozen embryo transfer. So it can be as little as $3,000 to $4,000, or even less, but probably around $3,000 would be the minimum. And it could go up, of course, using an infertility clinic. And then the specialized embryo donation centers, depending on what you're asking of them, can range anywhere from $9,000 to $16,000. And then using a donated embryo, an embryo donation through an adoption agency, again, sometimes called embryo adoption by these agencies, that can range anywhere from be as low as $6,000 up to $16,000. The distinction is what type of services either the donating couple or the recipient couple are expecting. But I wanted to throw that out because it is I think people don't realize that, in fact, it's probably the second least of the third-party reproduction options, the second least inexpensive, with donor sperm obviously being less. So anyway, okay, excellent. That was so helpful to kind of, because cost is a consideration.
Right, and of course I'm bundling legal in there too, so.
Good point. And let's see, yeah, that's a very good point. I'm so glad you brought that up. We did not include in this the legal fees, although it is usually rolled into the adoption agency cost. So the fees you see from adoption agency usually have the legal fees included, but with infertility clinics, almost never. So, yeah, thank you. That's a really good point. And we strongly encourage, to the point of insisting, that you get consult with an ART attorney, assisted reproductive technology attorney, which, let me put that out there, everybody, that is not the same thing as a family law attorney. We have an entire section where we discuss that on our site. So you do need an attorney that specializes in reproductive law. And we can help you find that. We have listings for organizations that have listed their members on our site. All right. We're coming to the end, and I do want to talk on, we got a couple of questions that I loosely termed ethical issues. One was somebody one of our community called Scott, named Scott. He said, we really had to consider the non-religious ethical side of using a donor. In Canada, donors cannot be compensated as they are in the U.S. In the U.S., the compensation can be quite high. In different countries overseas, they can be exploited due to poverty. For us, it was important to choose a place where they could be reasonably compensated for time and risk while not being put in a position where they were financially being coerced. All right, some thoughts, Andrea, on in specific, he was speaking of gamete donation. I don't think this would apply to embryo because, as we've discussed, that you're not purchasing embryos and you can't compensate a donating couple. And sperm generally is relatively inexpensive and a pretty much a set price. But we are talking, I think, with egg donation, and he didn't mention it, but I think surrogacy would also fall into that. Do you have any thoughts for how families, or should families, weigh their ethics and the ethics in general when making decisions on third-party reproduction?
I think it is critical for each person to weigh their own ethical values, thoughts, feelings around all of this. I think some people will select adoption just because the thought of compensating someone is inherently intertwined with potential coercion. And, you know, it comes down to the old joke, you know, of, you know, what's coercion? How much is it, what's the dollar amount on that? And, you know, it's no joke. I don't think there is agreement on this. Certainly we've seen globally that there are countries that say any compensation is considered coercion, and then they'll say except for costs associated with it, and then that gets a little bit more slippery there. But in the United States, you know, we have always valued individual autonomy, and certainly there was even a lawsuit brought about the idea of trying to keep compensation to donors from going to extraordinary heights, which could then be considered very coercive, and that was ultimately rejected. And so now there is really a sense of sort of a free market for donors mm-hmm. to be able to value what it means to them to be a donor and set their own price. Having said that, I always sort of flip to the end of the story, which is, as a parent, one of the reasons why you think you have to look at your own feelings around the ethics of this is, at some point, I think, as we've all talked about, these days parents tell their children that they were donor conceived, and with that comes the question of saying, well, what did it mean in terms of compensation, and how you feel about where that comes into talking with your child. And if you feel that it is in an ethically appropriate amount of saying that we valued her time, her effort, her risk in doing all of this, and that, you know, that we helped her and she helped us, and this is part of the family story that you know, most families are talking about, it's not an uncomfortable amount. If you're going to a country where you feel that the donors are really being exploited only for financial reasons, are powerless, and don't have a voice around what they are getting or how or what they're doing, I think then that could feel like a very different issue down the line for your child. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, I always say, You gotta think long term. Don't just think. Don't run just the short race. You gotta run the long race too with all of these issues.
And I am so appreciative that you continue to bring it back to, what are you going to tell your child? How might your child feel about this? So often we see people, and we totally understand this. Infertility sucks. They feel desperate. They feel under the gun. There's a time deadline. This has all taken so much longer than they thought. It has cost so much more money than they thought. And it's so unfair. And they're approaching this decision from that mentality. And I so very much appreciate that you're saying stop, breathe, think, not just short term. And it's not that the short-term issues are not important, because they are, but you also, in addition to thinking short-term, you must think long-term. what's the, and I'm quoting you, Andrea, what's the story you're going to tell your child, and how comfortable are you with that story? Because ultimately, that's something you must think about. I'm going to read two comments that we got, one from LinkedIn and one from Facebook, both very similar, and I think it's important to read them because there are many people who feel this way, and we'll let each of you share your thoughts on this. One from Cecile, she says, with so many children across the world desperate for families, to create a child from three parents is wrong on so many levels. Adoption is a positive option. And then one from Susan, I adopted and I passionately believe that we should first focus on those children who are already here and in need of love. All right, Colleen, any thoughts? There's not a wrong or a right answer, but any thoughts on this? Because it is an opinion that I think many, many people hold. I will say that oftentimes the people who hold this opinion have never faced the decision, but go ahead.
Right. So clearly there are lots of children that are in need of a forever family that are out there in our foster care system, but it really comes down to a matter of personal choice for that person that's looking to parent in terms of what child they feel capable of being able to parent. And the reality is, as you mentioned earlier, Dawn, most of the children that are legally free to be adopted are over the age of 6. It's pretty rare to find a child in the foster care system less than that age. Because it takes so long to terminate the underlying parental rights, the child typically, unless it's a very lucky child, has been in a number of foster homes. And they tend to have more behavioral issues from having been in a number of homes, reactive attachment disorder, or from the underlying issues that stem from their family of origin and being neglected or abused or whatever in that original home. Even during those very tender years, we know that first year of life is just so critical. So some families are more equipped to adopt a child from the foster care system and parent and love that parenting experience. Other families are not equipped for that, and they are also wanting to experience parenting a child from birth. They want to have a genetic connection, as Andrea mentioned. You know, for some people, it's very compelling. They want to have some genetic connection to their child. For others, it's not as critical. So it really comes down in a lot of ways to a matter of personal choice, and then a matter of people really kind of assessing who they are and what their strengths and weaknesses are, and are they going to be a good parent to this type of child, or are they going to be? Is it better that they're going to be a good parent to bringing the child into a world in another way?
Andrea, any parting thoughts on the moral superiority of one choice over another?
I have a hard time ever saying one is a better choice than another. I hear the passion behind both those comments, but I always caution everybody to be wary of not stepping into somebody else's shoes. And there are people make choices for many reasons, and I think that it's not fair to put an unfair burden on those who have experienced fertility problems to say that their feelings have to be different from others. You know, we do not walk up to somebody who has no fertility challenges and look at them and say, there are so many children out there that need forever homes. Why aren't you doing that? We accept the fact that people make those choices to go ahead and conceive on their own. And I guess I always am uncomfortable with the fact that just saying because you have fertility challenges means that your feelings have to be different. And Colleen pointed out so beautifully all the reasons why behind that. So I guess I advocate for a more compassionate view of others and just accepting that we all have our own thoughts and feelings and to respect them and go from there.
All right. Well said, all. Keep in mind when listening to this show that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how to apply it to your specific situation, please work with your infertility or adoption professionals. And we have a favor to ask. If you've enjoyed this show, do us a favor and help us grow. To do that, it's quick, it's easy. We just ask that you pop into iTunes and give us a ranking. It's a star ranking, or we'd also love your comments. We are by far the number one ranked show in both adoption and infertility, and iTunes uses our rankings, the ratings, in order to determine the rankings. So we would really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Andrew Braverman and Colleen Quinn, for being with us today on Creating a Family. To get more information about Colleen Quinn, you can go to her website, virginiaadoptionattorney.com. And to get more information about Andrea Braverman, the easiest way is to go to Thomas Jefferson University Departments of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and you can get the information. They'll be able to connect you to Andrea that way. I thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the...
Hey, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.